Interview with Alva Pillai, K, 10th of March,
1967. I was interested in the type of training you received, whether you felt that you were given enough instruction on the general problem.
No, I don't think you have any such practice at the time. Because when you were appointed those days, you were called cadets.
Yeah.
That term is not used now. Mm-hmm. The first 2 years you are supposed to be learning. But the superiors, they seldom took the trouble to give you any different instruction. Mm-hmm. You are supposed to learn yourself. You see, you ask others and find out what is what and so forth. Well, I can tell just one example. Normal civil servant in those days knew nothing when he took up office. You know, the system of recruitment is such that they went to the British system was built on the principle that you get a man of good general education and character come in. And then you expect him to pick up things.
To have the adaptability to learn
various kinds of work, and he has to pick up what is administration itself.
What did you read in London University? What subject?
I was in mathematics.
Oh, I see.
Even here, I got this scholarship in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And in only mathematics.
So who was your first GA in Anuradhapura?
Mr. Dyson.
And then in Matra?
Matra, this man called Worsley. You see, those days there were just a handful of Phoenix in the civil service. They worked on a ratio of two Europeans to one Phoenix. We didn't have the ratio even at the time, but they were working towards that.
Mm-hmm. And did they take you out on circuit?
That was the practice before my time.
Mm-hmm.
But I understood that the Europeans did not follow that as far as the Selenese in the service are concerned.
Mm-hmm. So did it apply to your case? They didn't take you out on circuit?
I seldom went on circuit with government agents. Then actually the first thing when you, first day you enter office, papers are there for you to sign.
Mm-hmm.
You are guided by
the piano,
the piano clerk, who says they'll have a sign here, and all sorts of terms are used in the minutes that come up. You have to call up chief clerk or somebody and ask them to remote in the mean.
What about the office assistants? Did they take some trouble to teach you?
They were expected to. Once in a way they gave useful hints. That was nothing very much. We used to have interesting experience with the office assistant I had. I don't remember Mr. Mogappa. He had to leave the service later on.
Who is it?
Mogappa.
Oh, an Indian?
No, he's a Sudanese.
Mm-hmm.
He had to leave the service later on. No, I just remembered it. He used to say, don't sign anything until you get the subject clerk or chief clerk to tell you, well, everything's in order.
Mm-hmm. Was Mogappa asked to leave on matter of discipline or?
Yes.
But that's very rare, isn't it? Did you feel that some sort of course on in law or principles of politics and something on land tenure, Sylvanese land tenure and land policy, things like that would have helped to collect some theoretical courses.
Certainly. But that was this time with Indian civil servants. You see, they, after passing out, they were allowed to go through a course, theoretical course in various subjects, land laws, revenue administration.
Mm-hmm.
But we were expected to study ourselves. You had the system of examination. There were two examinations in law, in financial regulations, for the language.
Yes. I suppose you had to learn Sinhalese.
Yes.
Were the examinations very strict or lenient?
No. In fact, I, you know, two Sinhalese examinations, I passed both in 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
They're not very high standard, but just enough for you to read a petition.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the system of petitions? Because they seem to have taken up a lot of the AGS time or the GS time, and many of them seem to be rather futile.
Well, under the system of administration then, which put the emphasis on keeping the peace, you know, law and order, the villager looked to the government agent, who is a representative of the government, to do everything for him, whether it is some land dispute or question of if he's not getting enough water for his paddy field. So for everything he wrote a petition. And whether the government agent had the real power to interfere or not, it's a different matter here. We also assumed that we must do something. For example, husband and wife fell out and they quarrel. Well, there's a petition. So it is sent to the revenue officer, who says, he sends it to the village, and he calls up the parties. And of course, people also believe that the government is something above them, and they must take the advice of the government official.
Mm-hmm.
Although there are many cases when they didn't take that advice, they refused to come to settlement, and of course, the revenue officer reports that nothing can be done. So the usual phrase we had when you get a report like that is LR, legal remedy. So the reply goes, you are referred to your legal remedy if so advised.
You can't omit
those sorts of issues if so advised, where he might turn around and say, well, I went to the courts and still I didn't get it. Why do you make me spend my time and money on it?
But did you feel that, especially in such cases, they were really asking you to do something which you couldn't do, where it was enough?
But the spirit of the administration was such that they didn't want to admit that they can't do anything. I suppose that follows from the fact that it was foreign rule.
Mm-hmm.
The village had be kept in the knowledge that the foreigner can do everything for him.
Yes, earlier on when they were trying to slow down the rate of Sylvanization, some of the Europeans argued that Sylvanese would never be trusted by the people because they say he has got a relative or some private interest or some private jealousy, and therefore that we can't have too many Sylvanese in service. How did you find it as, say, a Tamil in a Sinhalese area?
No, I don't think that argument has any validity, because the training you get, first the system of recruitment, and the idea you have formed of what the civil service is, that it's really what they used to call it, a steel frame, no?
Mm-hmm.
Which is no partiality, which looks at things objectively, whether you are a Tamil or a Sinhalese or a Brother or any other nationality, you have to follow a definite line that has been chalked out by the tradition.
How did you find Woolsey and Dyson as civil servants?
Well, one thing you could say generally that the European civil servants, they put emphasis on discipline in the service. Even a little thing that crops up, we have some instruction has been given. They impressed on the subordinate that it must be carried out. You see that there's no arguing or protesting. And of course, judging from the times, you see, the sphere of the civil servant was limited.
No question. Yes. Compared to now.
Now. Mm-hmm. So they were, they have gone through years of now, Dyson was about 25 years service when I went to work under him.
No, but by personal temperament, I would classify some civil servants as more the orthodox types, and others who tend to, when he called for, perhaps, or even if not called for, to be unorthodox and, you know, to do something outside the regulations, outside the normal sphere. I was wondering into what group Woolsey and Dyson were.
So they were of the orthodox type. Well, I would even say they were on the type that believed that the British acquired the colonies to bring good government to the eastern peoples.
Yes. What was the attitude to the question of rule, means, and on? I mean, did they have a sense of mission, or was it just another job for them?
No, I think they had a sense of mission. They, rightly or wrongly, they believed that people over whom they ruled, they were not quite fit to rule themselves, you know, so that they have to be not merely assisted. I don't know if they had any idea that it's only for the time, but they thought that they had discovered the methods of government and that they are the only people who can guide others.
So what was their attitude to the Donohoe Commission and their proposals?
I would say that they were not very much inclined to take any devolution responsibility on the people as a sound step. But I have one experience with an armed agent who definitely reported to his immediate superior on the question of converting a local boat to an urban council. He said that people can't use their boats properly, they will elect people who can't be dependent. Look after their face in the town. We won't have experience.
Mm-hmm. What about British civil servants when either as a judge or as an administrator, they were faced with a case between European and Assyrians? It is sometimes said that they invariably, even subconsciously, sided with the Europeans.
I don't agree with that. Particularly when he's in a judicial job, because even during my time, a large number of civil servants in judicial jobs, and I was a magistrate for some time. But once they are on that job, they kept the tradition that was ruling the judiciary is an independent service, whether it's a dispute with the government or the subject or persons of different religion or caste or nationality, I don't think they depart from the correct attitude.
Did you feel a change in the spirit of the service between, as after 1931, when we had mostly our own ministers. Did you feel that there was some more purpose than before?
Now coming to this normal period, I think after a few years, the attitude of the European civil servants also changed through their contact with our old ministers. By the time the proportion Ceylonese in the service had also increased. After 1934, recruitment of Europeans ceased altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, our ministers also had demonstrated, and by their policies and instructions, order they gave on administrative matters, they have probably proved in the eyes of the Europeans also that they are capable to attend to these matters of policy and so on. Then they have actually changed after that.
Mm-hmm. No, and in your own case, did you feel a new spirit, as if you were doing something?
Yes, because there was almost a drastic change from the old order, no, where you just look after revenue collection and keeping fees.
If I may touch on a rather awkward subject, because politically speaking, there was this trouble between the leading Tamil politicians and the Sinhalese politicians. Did you have doubts about the future?
No.
For instance, that there might be possible discrimination against Tamil government servants?
No. Those days, this idea of any differences arising never came to our minds. I mean, I would say even a single civil servant would have felt the same.
Mm-hmm. And what did you personally think about the grant of universal transit?
Well, judging by experience, by results, in the beginning it might have been a little premature. I say that because, you know, I was doing these elections under the new constitution. I think they had only two elections, one in 1931 and the other in 1936, both of which I presided.
That's in Bajra in 1936?
36 in Jaffna.
Jaffna.
I was magistrate there at that time. 31 I was in Puttalam. When people were too innocent of how to exercise their vote, and we had to have colored boxes and so on. But in spite of the disadvantage, it also threw up certain innate strength of the people, I mean, the common sense of the people and so on.
It is said that in these few years in particular, the headmen were able to exercise considerable influence.
Oh yes. Because they acquired that influence during the British times. For a certain period after the reforms were introduced, they continued to exercise that influence.
But on the voting itself, how would they use their influence?
Well, they knew the leaders of the village. They wanted to meet them and tell them
whom to vote for.
Yes.
What about registration? Did they falsify?
No, I don't see this.
Hmm.
It is not that competition from aspirants to become members of parliament as you have today. And I know it's true that prospective candidates, they went about collecting the forms, getting the signatures of people. In those days, every vote had to apply, sign or put his thumb mark. The aspirants did that themselves.
Could the aspirants check on the registration and make sure that it was correct? I mean, did they have access to the lists of registrants?
Yes, that's the law after the register is compiled. But I was doing this particular job of comparing the Vijayashta Vinayaka with Matra, it's printed. A press print comes and there's a notice that anybody can come and object to any name. But in actual fact, I don't think there are many objections or applications for insertion.
Probably because they were fighting individually, they didn't have the organization to check on everything.
But of course, those days there was plenty of room for impersonation.
And how did the aspirants campaign? I mean, the forms they use today are different.
Oh yes, today they combine a system of having meetings with house to house. But I don't think the system of house to house canvassing existed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, the electorate was large and compared to the
spread out.
Spread out. And they didn't probably want to spend money in that kind of canvassing.
And what did you think of the executive committee system?
Well, it only served the purpose for which it was intended, that is, to give sufficient scope for our people, our parliamentarians, to acquire experience of administration. During the earlier part of cases where there was interference by city committees with day-to-day administration.
Mm-hmm. And was this resented by the civil service?
Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. Did they?
Actually, the European civil servants.
Did they?
Well, I remember an anecdote that was during the time of Caldicott.
Yeah.
I think some European citizens must have complained to him that the minister is taking too much in administrative matters. So he issued a circular to all the heads of departments. I am not sure that it went to the ministers themselves. He quoted the outcome of a dispute in England between the minister and that happened years ago, between the minister and civil servant, where the civil servant replied that if the right honourable gentleman wants me to do a silly thing, certainly I will do it. But if he also wants me to do it in a silly manner, it will then be time for me to protest. So,
and in a sense, he was encouraging the civil servant to be independent.
Yes.
But wasn't Sayanayake himself the greatest interferer of all?
I had the experience of working with Sayanayake only after I came to the Republic of Food Department. He was on Food Minister for that time. By that time he had acquired a lot of experience. We started 1931. The normal interference, which probably you might find even today, is regard to these appointments.
Mm-hmm.
You see, ministers don't exactly tell you so and so is bad, so and so must be appointed. That they sort of drop hints. But even then, you can't say that they had any personal interest. You see, quite possibly they believe that certain persons will be more flexible when it comes to the question of implementing readily the policies. So that is one thing that the civil service lacked in the old days, the British days. There's no flexibility of mind. Civil servant tended to think in a groove sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't the executive committee system rather cumbersome and slow?
Oh yes, definitely.
In fact, what did you think of the way in which they handled matters in the committee, I mean the process and the discussion? Did they tend to squabble or...? organize the discussion barely?
Well, I came into direct contact with the executive system when I served as Secretary of Education. One thing I found was slow. Things got postponed. It's a system under which all the members had to meet often. And if they were inclined to become chancellor, they had to meet for long periods. But it's not possible for them to meet for long periods. So matters were postponed. Then there was a tendency to reconsider things, you know, to take a decision. And
the next time take it up again?
Yes, somebody, some afterthought, they come and place it again.
Any sort of infighting between members, I mean, an undue amount of it?
No, there used to be a lot of discussions, sometimes even heated discussions. Originally they had this provision that the chief secretary or legal secretary of these people could be present. I mean, the idea was that they could bring a sort of moderating influence towards the discussions. I think that tended to help some extent.
In your time, did any of them come?
Oh, yes.
What sort of man was Vedapan?
He was very level-headed and well-experienced. Mm-hmm. Particularly in problems relating to Ceylon.
Woodman, Colin, Drayton?
I won't say that a Woodman. Woodman was a little of imperialist type.
Mm-hmm.
More limited range of vision. Collins was a very good man.
Did you feel that the minister was able to control the meeting? Because, I mean, in day-to-day committee meetings, the role of the chairman is fairly vital. If he keeps them on the ball and to the point, it helps. Did you feel that the minister was able to do that?
Well, yes. Well, when things get out of control at one meeting, when they had some divisive, well, it is think it over, postponed. Mature consideration.
Yeah, but this is a physical silliness habit too. And sometimes you feel like there's a bit of love rolling. You, all right, I'll give you this, you give me this, you see. And sometimes a middle path which helped not solve the problem. Just because there's a conflict of opinion.
Well, in a few matters you could guess that. These things were not openly done. If they want to make such arrangements, probably they made it outside the meeting.
I noticed that you had, for a very short time, you were secretary to the Board of Ministers too.
Ah, yeah, I was acting for Mr. Kanagar.
What was your impression?
Well, at that time, the chairman was the chief secretary.
Yeah.
The leader of the house was only vice chairman. I attended only a few meetings. It was Vedapan.
But he didn't have a vote. I mean, he just...
He used to sort of calm frayed tempers and put his point of view.
Who were taking a leading part in the Board of Ministers at that time?
Mr. Sennac was the vice chairman.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean in the conversations that you can recall, who tended to be, shall I say, take a rather forward position?
Trying to recollect what year it was.
39. Korea would have been in there. Perhaps. Kotula would have.
No. If it was 39, then Sir Bharat was there.
Still
a
leader, no?
Yes. Sir Bharat left only 1942. Well, even during Sevabhava's time, Mr. Sennaker, who took a prominent part, and Mr. Koray was also very effective.
They view that these three policemen were that they were a bit of a hindrance and they could block essential registration. Did you feel that this was
no.
so?
I was once present, no, that was in the, I think in the Executive Committee of Education, in the Japan Airway,
and
Sir Robert Drayton came to the meeting, the issue was of the closure of schools in Colombo. When Mr. Kanangra was minister, he was opposed to closing. So some of the executive members also, Drayton rubbed this point over and over and to the extent of saying, well, it's an emergency, it's a matter which Governor may have to even override you.
Mm-hmm.
So these people gave in.
I see. Yes.
But that was only characteristic of Drayton. I don't mean any other.
He forced his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So this would imply that he may not have been popular with the politician.
Yes, he was not at all popular. He was legal secretary. I wouldn't say he was cut out to be an administrator, position of the chief secretary. He was legal secretary because Woodman got into trouble
with
the bombing. You see, overnight he was asked to leave and Drayton took over. Later on I met Drayton in Pakistan. He was a little sad man.
Why?
I don't know. They didn't let him stay too long here. And I know that he was trying to ingratiate himself with Mr. Sennaker.
Oh yes, was there a feeling, especially among the European diehards, that Drayton and Nihil and Collins and a few others were working far too closely and secretly with Sennaker?
Collins, I know he was the Padre type, no? He was fairly liberal minded and not of the authoritarian type. He looked up to the our people, our ministers, some respect and so on.
I have a feeling that Drayton was unpopular with the civil servants too. Why?
Well, that he was a very strict minister. Maybe partly to the fact that those days the European civil servant looked up to the chief secretary's position as their plum.
Oh, and they couldn't get it, you see, he's an outsider. Another aspect of administration was after 48, really even in the Donovan times, did you feel that because technical heads of departments had to come into contact with ministers, there was a lot of friction because they couldn't understand each other?
Well, I would say that because I myself became head of department in 1945, yes. I was deputy before that in the food department. In 1945, I became director of food supplies.
Who was the minister? Sennaker?
Sennaker.
No, but in your case, you were an administrator and a Ceylonese. I was thinking particularly of the irrigation department and the police department and the survey department, the technical men. It is said that they couldn't get on with their ministers.
Well, if at all there was any dispute or difference of view, would have only received all appointments, you know, promotions and so on. The Europeans had probably this weakness by being in the same department, these technical departments, too long. So they developed some affections towards particular officers. Maybe they are officers or business officers. In matter of promotion, they might have been different opinion, because minister, they had other means of informing themselves about competence of officers.
And what do you think of the system of having a public service commission? Has it answered its purpose?
Yes, I think so. It's the purpose being to keep the public service neutral and to continue to put the emphasis on merit, which was the consultation and the principle the British introduced. Which has achieved a fair amount of success. Although in later times, you know, we used to talk in drawing rooms about how some appointments had gone
Yes, I feel there is a feeling today that the Public Service Commission is, by and large, a tool in the hands of the existing cabinet.
But certain conventions develop in the course of time. They say when it comes to the question of appointment of head of department, this is what I heard. There is an arrangement between the chairman of the Public Service Commission and Minister concerned, that the minister should be consulted, unofficially. But my time as permanent secretary, I always, the constitution is the permanent secretary who has the right to make a recommendation. I made up my own mind, but of course you have to inform the minister.
And if he went against it, you have to accept it?
Yes.
It is said that, I mean, that several permanent secretaries in the 50s, even in DS's time, UNP rule, and especially in Banna's time, tended to ride with the minister and annoying his views, present something that he was fond of.
No, I mean, generally, the practice is permanent secretary who has the right to initiate, he gives his point of view to the minister, then listens to the minister's point of view, and they come to some decision where one is converted by the other.
But I mean, what happens if a permanent secretary decides that the minister was had made a silly decision and wanted to apply it in a silly way?
But in my experience, after our independent constitution, that kind of situation seldom arose.
Mm-hmm. You didn't have to experience.
But of course, you see, we also took this precaution, and because after the independent constitution, there was a change which affected all public servants, that they are also once in a way brought into the limelight. Their actions are queried in parliament, in the press and so on. So in purely matters of organization, administration, where they could have proceeded as they wanted, they consulted the minister. They drew up a plan and had put it to the minister in writing, or explained to him and got his view. The minister suggests something worthwhile incorporating, and that was done.
But were there any examples or instances of a big clash which led to the permanent secretary being changed? There must have been a couple.
There have been changes, I know. But the reasons didn't come out in public. There were changes effected within a week. Possibly that the minister was not satisfied with the pace set by the Prime Minister. Because particularly in recent times, ministers were very keen that the activities of the ministerial department should be expedited, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite natural because they expect to the people to know what they are doing, their departments are doing, and they expect to get a lot of kudos over that. Yes, I was in his stand.
Shali or? No. Ah, yes,
no. LJ. LJ was changed by Stanley. Yes, LJ. Yes, I wanted. Stanley wanted. Yes, I was
thinking. Oh, I see.
Then LJ was given this official language commission post. Munaratna, he was my batch. So 1 year before me, he didn't hit it. Well, that Mrs.
Vimala Vijayawan.
Yeah.
And he asked to leave or?
Yes.
Yes, there were some ministers who were more prone to interfere, I presume, than others. I think Ilana Ratna had that reputation, didn't he?
No, I got to him for 1960 July to 63 March, that time. I got on very well with him.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yes.
How did you find him as administrator rather than...
Well, actually, he... I must say, well, among the many ministers I worked, he left administration entirely. But his forte was sending out minutes every now and then.
Policy or?
Incorporating complaints he hears from outside. And please do something about it. He never went to the extent saying do this or you should not have done that or anything.
So did that mean that you had to report back to him on that matter?
No, not necessarily. Unless it is an important thing, I will, when I meet him, then I will explain to him.
How did you find Sir Oliver's way of doing business as a Deputy Civil Commissioner?
Well, Sir Oliver was described by Dayton at that time as he's a first-class administrator. That is when he was going to Delhi to negotiate some food supplies, which we were in sore need at that time. But his great point was his memory. He carried details in his mind. And he didn't write long minutes. He seldom wrote about minutes. He discussed matters and said, well, because his great point was he selected his people. He had a good judge of men. He selected the type of people who can be dependent on to be on the room.
Did you serve under him as a minister too? I mean, was he a minister?
Yes, 19. When the UNP got back in 52. 52, yes. He became a Swami Pashan too.
He has a reputation of being a sort of Gopiya Pasha.
No, he has some persuasive manners. And he pleads and tries to convert the opponent. And of course, too, he has succeeded in many of his missions.
So you think he was a good negotiator too? What did you feel about the way things were going after independence, 48 to say 52 and then again 52 to 56, UNP rule, did you feel that things were going down here?
No, I didn't get that impression. All that criticism arose after the UNP was defeated, that they had not taken their job seriously and looking after their favorites and things like that.
No, but for instance, I mean, a factor which contributed to the defeat, the feeling that they were too flashy and not, you know, everything good for their supporters, but no consideration for the common man. That sort of feeling?
Because they lost the common touch, that is true. But I won't say that in their policies of administration, they neglected the common man.